Morning, Chief Judge. Chief Judge Santel, may it please the court. It has long been established that the president cannot make intra-session recess appointments where the Senate convenes into sessions every 3 days. That is precisely what it did here.
Established by who?
Your Honor, ever since Attorney General Daugherty issued the executive branch opinion that there were such a thing as an intra-session recess appointment.
That establishes the law?
I would say it's established
I don't think you want to start with the executive branch view of this establishes, because the executive branch view is all over the place.
That's a good point, Your Honor. Let me start this way. No president has ever made an intra-session recess appointment when the Senate had not recessed when the Senate had held sessions for every 3 days. It's a power that's never been exercised. Here, the Senate actually held sessions every 3 days. It said it was going to hold those sessions. It actually held those sessions. And we know that those were actual sessions during which the Senate was capable of conducting business.
Can I ask you sort of a background question?
Yes, Your Honor.
We have, the D.C. Circuit over the years has assiduously stayed away from separation of power disputes in general whenever we can, and from recess appointment clause disputes in particular. We really haven't weighed in on this because we've assumed, I guess, that like in McAlpin, that we'll leave this up to the thrust and parries of the political branches. Why isn't your remedy here why isn't the remedy of the Senate here to use the tools that have been afforded them by the Constitution and fight back that way? Why drag us in it?
Because, Your Honor, this is not just a dispute between the Senate and the President. This is a dispute between the Noel Canning Corporation and the National Labor Relations Board. The federal law gives Noel Canning the right to come to this court to challenge the order entered.
That raises another question that we'll go back to the others in a minute. I cannot for the life of me figure out why this intervention question was ever raised. Your side caused this by trying to intervene. As you just said, Noel Canning had a live dispute, a good, clean lawsuit. The issue would have been squarely before us. So you've got all of these extra pages, all of this extra briefing, argument, no doubt legal fees, to insert an intervener, which can't possibly change the outcome of the case. Why should we say the intervention is proper?
You are absolutely correct that address the issue regardless of whether you grant the motion for intervention. We think intervention is proper because we satisfy the standards for intervention under Rule 15D. Regardless of however,
you got to end up writing the briefs anyway, right?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
You got to end up writing the briefs anyway.
At a minimum, we did get to do that. Yeah. And regardless of how you resolve that question, the court will need to wrestle with the difficult recess appointments question. And I think it is a justiciable question because this is a dispute between Noel Canning and the National Labor Relations Board.
Right.
Just as in the Zivotofsky case, it's precisely the type of question that courts are called upon to resolve. And when you look at the applicable standards here we know for certainty that the Senate actually held sessions.
But did it do any work between December 23rd and January 23rd? Did the Senate do any work?
Well, it convened on January 3rd.
I know it convened. The question is, did it do any work?
I would say it convened on January 3rd. That's the one piece of work that it did that period. But that cannot be the test. The test cannot be how busy is the Senate during the sessions that is
I understand that's a different question, but my simple question is, did they do any work? And you're saying the only work they did between December 23rd and January 23rd convening for the pro forma sessions.
Yes, Your Honor, but we know for certainty that throughout the entire period during which it was subject to this adjournment order and convening in actual sessions every 3 days, those were, in fact, actual sessions during which it was capable of conducting business, because it conducted business on December 23rd when it passed a major law, and it passed another law.
On January 23rd, the leader gets up and says, welcome everybody back from our long break. We're now going to take up some of these issues that we've put off. We've got a nomination for Judge Girard. I can't remember. Getting the name wrong, we're going to take that up. That all suggests that they weren't doing anything.
But they had the capability of doing things. They were actually in sessions. That's the key test here. Were they in session? The government wants you to look behind the fact that they were actually gaveling into session and to conclude that those sessions were shams during which the Senate was incapable of conducting any work. We know that that's not the case because they conducted work during some of these sessions, at least on December 23rd and August 11th. And I would submit that that session was no different than the others. There were two members present on December 23rd. It lasted a minute and 25 seconds.
That's why I asked between December 23rd and January 23rd. Take December 23rd out of it, and you've got a problem.
And there's no magic line between December 23rd and January 23rd and December 17th, when the adjournment order was entered, and December 23rd. The Senate, on December 17th, scheduled a single adjournment order. It said, we are going to hold sessions, actual sessions, every 3 days. It then held those sessions. And that's the line between recess and not recess. Were they holding sessions? Not were they busy. I would submit to you, if you flip on C-SPAN on any given day, you will often see a Senate that is not particularly busy.
Well, they're doing other things.
Perhaps.
No,
perhaps.
They're doing a lot of other things.
But if you look at the Senate floor,
the former Senate counsel on that question.
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at the Senate floor, there's usually a presiding senator accompanied by a full complement of staff, maybe one or two other senators. That's precisely, I would submit, if you looked at any of these sessions.
But besides action on the floor, was there any other work that was going on in the Senate between December 23rd and January 23rd?
Your Honor, not that I am aware of, other than convening on January 3rd to meet the constitutional obligation under the 20th Amendment.
So to your knowledge, the only work being done by the Senate between December 23rd and January 23rd were the pro forma convenings. No committees were meeting, nothing like that? No hearings being held?
Your Honor, not that I am aware of. They were doing work in the sense that they were gaveling open, a full complement of Senate staff was available to assist if needed, and they were fully capable of conducting work. I would submit that it's no different than if President Obama pencils into his calendar, I'm taking Saturday off, no business to be conducted. That doesn't give Vice President Biden the power to seize the reins of the federal government, because President Obama nonetheless is capable of doing work available if he wants to.
Why aren't you arguing that that recess appointment clause applies, it gives the president power only to make intercession recess? Why aren't you making that?
Well, Your Honor, we think that this is a narrower ground upon which you can dispose of the case and accord us full relief. We have briefed that issue.
So what's the principle? I mean, intercession versus intrasession, that's a nice, neat principle. Happens to have the advantage of comporting with the text and the history. What's the principle that you identify?
It's a very neat principle, I would suggest. Once you jump once you make the leap into intra-session recesses, it's necessary to establish some kind of constitutional floor. Otherwise, you do descend into absurdity. Lunch breaks, when the court stepped out for a minute to allow the
constitutional floor.
The constitutional floor is the one found in the adjournment clause.
And where does that come from?
Your Honor,
by coincidence, the adjournment clause.
The adjournment
talks about
clause, which you don't put in the statutory sections at the back of your brief.
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor. We quoted it extensively in the brief, and that was an oversight.
It's a lot easier to find if you comply with the practice of putting the ones you rely on in the brief.
Yes, Your Honor. But the adjournment clause, the recess appointments clause, they're of a piece with four different clauses in the Constitution, all of which turn on constitutional availability and unavailability. Along, you've got the adjournment clause, 20th Amendment, pocket veto clause, recess appointment.
That the framers thought that the recess appointments clause was informed by the adjournment clause?
Well, Your Honor, I do, actually. I think that at the time, the recesses that they were grappling with were very long intercession recesses. So they didn't really need to directly confront 3 days versus 5 days versus 10 days. But I do believe that they thought that this was something that was quite substantial.
They used the adjournment clause if they needed to take a break, right?
They used the adjournment clause when they needed to take a break of longer than 3 days. Essentially, what the purpose, though, is to prevent them from taking extended breaks and absenting themselves from capability of conducting business without the joint consent of both houses. Frankly, it's the same purpose as the recess appointments clause. The recess appointments clause is meant to say that if you take an extended break and render yourself unavailable to do business, that's when a special power kicks in, the recess appointment power. Much like the pocket veto clause, when the Congress renders itself unavailable to do business, unavailable to receive a bill from the president gets a special power.
So the narrowest holding you're looking for is 3 days, right?
These particular recess appointments are unconstitutional because the Senate was meeting every 3 days. We have briefed the other issues. They are in the briefs. They're presented to the court for decision. We think you can decide this on a much narrower ground by concluding that no president has ever made a recess appointment where Congress, the Senate, was actually holding sessions every 3 days,
here. Session, that's a new device. I mean, it's a fairly new device. I mean, apparently Senator Byrd discussed it with President Reagan, but it hasn't been used until just the last couple of
years. Your Honor, I think that reflects the fact that the aggressive use of intra-session recess appointments is a fairly new device. Prior to 1945, there are only three times where an intra-session recess appointment was made. Once by Andrew Jackson, Johnson during the Civil War.
He doesn't have a real good record on appointments clause.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And then Warren Harding made one. Calvin Coolidge made one. After 1945, it started to be used intermittently. It wasn't until during the Carter and Reagan administrations, however, that presidents started using it aggressively to do end runs around Senate advice and consent. So it makes perfect sense that is precisely when Senator Byrd stepped forward and pushed back using the Senate's tools. I think it's important to look at the flip side. Congress has been using these types of pro forma sessions since the 1920s. The House, I believe, since 1929, the Senate since 1949, for a variety of legislative purposes. And throughout that time, we have been unable to disclose even a single instance of the president treating these pro forma sessions as if they were recesses. And that's because the line is the Senate holding sessions every 3 days. Frankly, it's not up to the executive branch to look behind that to determine whether or not these are, in fact, sham sessions. But if you did look behind that to ask whether or not they are sham sessions, you would easily conclude that they are not. That's precisely why the Senate was able to pass major legislation on December 23rd and August 11th by unanimous consent, which, by the way, is how the Senate confirms the vast majority of nominees that come before it and pass the vast majority of legislation that comes before it.
Not everyone, unfortunately.
Not every nominee, Your Honor, but some of them.
Not every nominee on this bench
by unanimous consent.
The majority of them people.
I didn't say all.
Let's move on.
I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, but I'm happy to answer.
You don't get to right now. Reminded us at the beginning of this something that seems to have been forgotten, and that is that there is an actual dispute here between Noel Canning and the NLRB.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're supposed to be representing Noel Canning. You said, as it stands, nothing on their behalf. Is there anything in their position that isn't dependent upon us applying state law to govern the contract?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor, the substantial evidence test. I would submit to you that even if you accept all of the union's testimony as true here, it establishes two things, that on December 8th, the parties allegedly entered into a tentative oral agreement on one thing, and then on December 15th, when the union voted on that thing, it voted on something that was different than what was tentatively agreed to, even on their own testimony, on December 8th. And so there was no meeting of the minds. So we don't think that the board's order is supported by substantial evidence. Regardless, however, I think that Noel Canning has a very distinct interest in the recess appointments question here.
There's no question but what Noel Canning has that interest. Nonetheless, this is an NLRB administrative review proceeding that we're sitting on today.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I did not want that to get completely lost. You understand, it isn't guaranteed that you're going to win on recess appointments. If you don't win on recess appointment, then we have to decide the labor law case.
I fully understand.
That's why Mr. Copas is over here at the table.
And that's why we briefed it. That's why I'm prepared to answer any questions on it. And we think it's a very strong argument for the reasons that I just articulated.
Can I ask you about something you haven't briefed, and I don't think any other party has to, and that's our jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because this issue was not brought before the NLRB, which is jurisdictional.
Mm-hmm.
And are you relying, obviously, on the – well, what are you relying on?
Well, two things, Your Honor. One, it's well established that you don't have to raise before an administrative agency something they have no authority to resolve. And the NLRB itself, in the Center for Social Change case, the one that got dropped out –
case was brought.
Yes. Yeah. The Center for Social Change clarified that pursuant to its usual standard, it actually has no authority to second-guess the president's decision on this. So we don't have to bring before the board something they have no authority to resolve. The board obviously doesn't have the power to overrule their boss, the president, on whether or not the recess appointments are valid. And relatedly, you don't have to raise futile issues before the board. I would suggest here that there is a huge cloud hanging over the National Labor Relations Board proceedings right now. This case is fully briefed. The prudent thing for this court to do would be to remove that cloud one way or the other.
Are you relying on the language of the statute that refers to, I believe, exceptional circumstances?
Excuse me?
You look like you're surprised. The statute makes this jurisdictional. It says we're not here unless except in, what, exceptional circumstances or something to that effect?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I'm not sure why this would take you by surprise, but...
And that's what you're relying on.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Do you have further question or... Seeing no further questions, then your time is up. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors. And Chief Justice Santella, may it please the court. The fundamental question, to offer a somewhat different perspective, though I think I largely agreed with a lot of what Mr. Francisco said.
You won't need to talk long, man, will you?
My somewhat different perspective on the fundamental question in this case is whether the Senate is empowered to provide for its own internal operating procedures by a unanimous consent resolution on December 17th, then from that date...
There's no question that the Senate, under the Rules Clause, gets to make the rule of its own proceedings, but where has the Senate made the determination that what the word recess means for purposes of the Recess Appointments Clause? There's nothing in the standing rules of the Senate, right?
No, but the question...
There's nothing in Riddick's about it, and the Senate isn't here to tell us what their view is. They've chosen, for whatever reason, not to appear as an amicus. So how do we know what the Senate's view is about the meaning of recess in terms of the Recess Appointments Clause? We don't.
We know two things that are highly probative and I think virtually established, the answer that the Senate has to give to that. One of them is that by the order that I just cited, the Senate declared that it would hold sessions every 3 days between December 17th.
But that's not answering the question of whether the Senate considers that to be a recess under the Recess Appointments Clause or not.
No, but I think it is widely understood on the part of the senators, including the current majority leader, who so stated in 2007 providing for a pro forma session precisely to prevent the then incumbent president from making recess appointments.
So is that how we figure out what the Senate thinks of something? We look at statements by the majority leader in the congressional record? There's a statutory mechanism for the Senate to present its views of the rules of its own proceedings in court, right? It's statutory. It's
right, but the mere
Title II, and they haven't done that here. So what is there for us to defer to?
Well, what is there to defer is two issues. The Senate, by unanimous consent, that is to say the entirety of the Senate, said that it would be in session, which I think is the polar opposite of being in recess. And
perhaps, but is that the Senate addressing this issue? The meaning of being in session for terms of the Recess Appointment Clause?
Well, I think it is necessarily the Senate dealing with that very same question, Judge Griffith, because...
Why isn't the Senate here? Why didn't they appear to brief this issue?
I don't believe the legal counsel has sought authorization, which would then be a votable proposition. I don't think that the presence of the Senate is necessary. One of the issues
The implication is there are not enough votes to get a Senate resolution to do so. So what does that tell us about the Senate's view of this issue?
I don't think it tells us anything about the motivations of individual senators.
I'm not talking about motivations of individual senators because those are irrelevant. We're talking about you want us to defer under the rules of its own proceedings clause, and you're right. We have to defer to the Senate's view of its own proceedings. I'm saying, where is that? It's not here.
It is.
We have to, you're trying to glean it from floor statements and by indirection.
I don't think that it is fair to say, Judge Griffith, that I'm arguing from indirection when the Senate provided for the sessions every 3 days for the purpose of complying with constitutional requirements, including the adjournment clause and the 20th Amendment.
Was that part of the unanimous consent?
Well, what was part of the unanimous consent was two things, that the Senate will hold sessions every 3 days, and that those sessions during that period, business of the Senate could be conducted only by unanimous consent. And the argument that we make here is that that necessarily means that the Senate declared itself by unanimous consent to be available for business, that it stated expressly that it was in session.
Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's imagine that the Senate finishes its work on Labor Day, but then goes into a series of pro forma sessions that last until January 2nd. That's the only thing that's taking place in the Senate between Labor Day and January 2nd. Does that preclude the president from making an appointment in November or December?
Oh, yes. And I think one of the...
There's absolutely nothing happening in the Senate. There are no hearings. No one's in town. The buildings are dark, except for every 3 days, the junior senator has to come in and gavel them in, right? And that's the only thing that's happening. And
Griffith, I am answering your question, yes, but I am also taking issue with the supposition, which I think was also implicit in your question to my colleague, that that was what was occurring here. Because what the resolution in this case said was that business could be conducted by unanimous consent, and that means the enactment of legislation or business that requires a vote of the Senate as a whole. It does not mean that nothing was happening, and in fact, the legislative record affirmatively refutes the supposition that something was happening, that nothing was happening, because if you look at the congressional record, for example, on January 23rd, at page S41, you could see that under the authority of the very same resolution, the reports of a number of committees that have been working during this period of time were actually tendered. And so the whole proposition that this is in some respect different from how legislative business is conducted in the ordinary course is simply false. And in most cases where you deal with sessions such as you describe, as a matter of principle, I think that deference to the role of the Senate in the constitutional process and the primacy of the advice and consent function as the primary and not an auxiliary method for the appointment of officers, it means that the court must defer to the Senate calling its work a session in the absence of the most affirmative evidence that this is the clearest subterfuge. What the Supreme Court said in the Bolling case, which dealt with the quorum rule of another house, was that even if somebody were prepared to come in and say there was nobody in the chamber, and under the house rules, people were sent to look to see if somebody was in the building, that was for the house to determine whether the quorum was present.
That's right. But the difference there is there was some form of certification that was made by the body itself. That we don't have that here. We might be able to infer that from statements that are made, but
I don't think that that's actually fair, Judge Griffith, because the certification is inherent in the act that the Senate was gaveled into session officially as the Senate, not as two guys in a bar, every 3 days. You know, the parliamentarian was there, everybody who's needed to conduct the legislative business of the people.
Why have you not advanced the original public meaning argument of the recess appointments clause, that there is the recess, there's a single recess?
We have not disputed two things.
Kind of faint-hearted, aren't we? Yes.
Well, if you had offered me twice as many words, I would have been happy.
Well, I'm also might ask why all the litigants were so reluctant to make that clause easy to find in your brief.
I'm sorry, just
I also don't understand why no litigant here makes the clause easy to find in the briefs. Nobody put it in the sections on the back of a statutory appendix. Contrary to what your co-counsel said, it isn't laid out very plainly at the beginning of their brief. We have to hunt the clause that everybody's relying on. Excuse me, go ahead.
Well, that's, That is
I'm just being a curmudgeon, my usual role of curmudgeon, but excuse me, go ahead.
Well, and I think, you know, we all owe you an apology for that. But the basic point is that the Senate as a body officially gaveled into session with everybody who works for the Senate on hand and ready to conduct the business of the people if the business that was consensual enough to warrant unanimous consent was tendered for resolution. And the issue here is not that the Senate was not available, as the executive would have you think, but that the Senate adopted a special supermajority rule for this period of time to consider only certain things. If you accept the government's so-called functional view, which keeps evolving with each successive and affirmative grab of the power of the Senate, the next argument is going to be that the cloture rule means that the Senate is not available for nominations, or that the invocation of the so-called Thurman rule in an injunction in an election year means that the Senate is not available for business. The reason we did not think necessary to make the Arise argument and the, you know, the reasons of the Senate argument is that although we agree and we do not disavow those arguments, this wolf comes as a wolf. If you accept this invocation of executive power, you have turned the auxiliary process for filling of the appointments on a somewhat of an emergency basis. What the framers put in, like break glass in case of emergency, part of the Constitution, and you have turned it into the background rule that would allow the president to evade the primary role of the Senate in securing advice and consent of his nominees, which is the main route for a nomination and confirmation.
And we have reached and passed the end of your allotted time, so unless my colleagues have further questions, I think the counsel will hear from the respondent, the first counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, Beth Brinkman from the Department of Justice, appearing on behalf of the National Labor Relations Board, along with my NLR. I'll be addressing the recess appointments clause.
Let me say at the outset that I am going to arbitrarily and capriciously and without consulting with my colleagues raise the time limits on both of the other council to 5 minutes apiece. This started out, after all, in their bailiwick, and 3.5 and 1.5 is not much time to talk in, so you can be thinking about saying more than you'd previously planned to say.
Thank you very much. My colleague from the NLRB, Elizabeth Heaney, will be addressing the labor issues. I'd like to turn first back to the recess appointments clause, which is the provision of the Constitution that vested the president with the authority to make these appointments. And I'd like to look at the text of that clause, which uses the term recess.
The recess.
Yes. That's right, Your Honor.
Don't cut it short, please, counsel.
Absolutely, the recess. The recess has a common, ordinary meaning.
Yes, it means does. And it's a definite article. It does not say a recess or recess. It says the recess.
Let me turn to the intra-session question then, I guess, to begin with, although I very much like to get back to the core meaning of recess. But we take great issue with the characterization of the history of this text in the Constitution.
When was the first time the executive took the view that the recess appointment clause gave the president power to make intra-session recesses?
Well,
other than Andrew Johnson.
Since that time, there have been 285, and certainly
it was 1921.
But if I can go before that, Your Honor, I would counter with the Senate's position, which dates back to 1798. This same language, the recess, appeared in Article 1, Section 4, which was the first provision that defined how senators were selected. It's now been overtaken by the 17th Amendment, but we go back to that original language, and it allowed the state executives to fill vacancies, and it used the same language. In 1798, the New Jersey executive, there was a vacancy, and he filled that senatorial vacancy, which had during the intra-session of the New Jersey legislature, unlike Congress that was not engaging in intra-sessions at that time, the New Jersey legislature was, and we explained this in our brief, and the Senate accepted that commission. There was a meaning of the recess. It included intra-session.
How strong is that as precedent for the meaning of the recess in the appointments clause?
It's the exact same text contemporaneously drafted by the same individuals to serve the same purpose. Vacancies, temporary, and it was a temporary appointment. It was completely analogous to the recess appointments.
That was at a time when the states controlled, subject to the Constitution, the senatorial selection process.
That's your right.
So once the state has made that decision, does it mean anything more than deference on the part of the Senate that they accepted that with reference to the state legislature?
We think it's very sound and the most contemporaneous history we have about what the drafters of the Constitution meant about used those exact words.
Why wasn't it ever used for that until so long after? I mean, it's not likely that executives don't take advantage of power that's given to them. I mean, we've sort of learned that in history. So, but you're saying here is a power that was given to the executive and wasn't used until, again, with the exception of Andrew Johnson, 1921. That seems implausible to me.
A couple things, Your Honor. Historically, there weren't long intra-session recesses, just as a fact of Congress as opposed to the state legislative example we give. And we would also point out that...
But there were intra-session recesses. They went to lunch. They took weekends. They had holidays.
But since 1921, the Attorney General's opinion has made clear that this is an interpretation and has been embraced. Subsequently, the 11th Circuit and Bank has also reached this conclusion, and there have been 285 appointments, and we think under the Supreme Court's
In 1901, the executive took the view that there were no intra-session, right? So, I mean, the executive's track record on this has been checkered at best, right?
We now have nearly 100 years, Your Honor, and I think under the Supreme Court's command of Mistretta and similar cases where it teaches us that the traditional ways of conducting government do inform constitutional interpretation, that is something to be taken into heart here. This would be a significantly...
And that's a stronger argument on the arising, on the happens, right? Because that goes, you go back to, 1823 or so, and maybe even George Washington. But this one is a little more temporary. But you're saying 1921 is enough.
I think that, Your Honor, the disruption...
And then we have three presidents who didn't do, JFK, LBJ, and Ford wouldn't do intercession.
But there are various reasons, as Your Honor well knows, why there might or might not be appointments at a certain time. The fact of the matter is, in a well-reasoned opinion from 1921, Attorney General Dougherty, made clear the reasoning that has been carried forward. The 11th Circuit and Bank, in addressing Judge Pryor's appointment, agreed with this conclusion. And the command of looking at the practice of conducting government is a significant factor to be weighed there. I would like to go back to the text of the word recess and to talk about that common ordinary meaning that we are taught to use.
I'm not sure you're going to get far with that without going to the term the recess.
And, Your Honor, we think that with a century of precedent and the...
Forget about a century of precedent. Go back to the Constitution. That's where you said you were going. Go back to the text. You said you were going there.
Yes.
The recess, I do not see how you can read that without taking that to mean a specific recess as opposed to the generality of recess.
Well, Your Honor, Attorney General Dougherty discussed this, and when you look at the recess...
He wasn't around at the time. When you said you were going back to the text. That was 100 and some odd years before Dougherty.
When you look at the recess, we already know it doesn't mean a single recess in the suggestion that of your interpretation that you're suggesting of the, because there are at least two annual sessions for each Congress. So there are... recesses, even if you're only looking at inter-session.
Between those sessions, there is the recess.
But for one Congress, there is more than one recess, even under that interpretation, Your Honor. And when we...
Is it the New Jersey, the example of the New Jersey legislature that you're relying on?
Yes, it is.
Any other example?
And the New Jersey governor. That's the one we found from 1798, which we think is...
Because the typical practice for state legislatures at the time was to have a single, a short session, single recess, right? Same practice as was the National Congress.
And this is contemporaneous evidence of the exact same language in a different provision of the Constitution for the same purpose.
Speaking of purpose, I mean, so Federalist 67 and Story tell us what the purpose of the recess appointment clause was, right? And the it was actually an accommodation to the senators. Here they're given this advice and consent function in the appointment clause. They have to go home. The president has to be here 365 days a year. The executive power needs to keep going on. He needs to fill vacancies as an accommodation to the Senate. They get to go home, and he gets to exercise this power. That was the purpose behind this, right? What's it being used for now? It's being used now when a president is frustrated by what the Senate's doing, right? The purpose has changed dramatically.
Your Honor, we would say that our position is the consistent and maintains the balance of powers that Your Honor invoked at the beginning. The design of the recess appointment.
I want to talk about purpose. You've done text. So
the purpose of the recess appointments clause is to ensure that the appointment authority is vested at all times somewhere.
Right.
Under the petitioner's view, they create an appointment vacuum. Under their view, during this 20-day break from business in January, they claim the president is not authorized to exercise his recess appointments authority.
That's what the law
but at the same time.
Ms. Brinkman, I think the problem I have with that argument is it's missing the forest for the trees argument. The forest here is that presidents, not just this one, presidents have become frustrated at the way the Senate has treated their nominations, right? These are nominations that are presented to the Senate and not acted upon quickly enough by the president. And so the president, the executive branch, resorts to these almost metaphysical arguments about the recess appointments clause. That's not what the recess appointments clause was about. It was not a chance to give a president a second chance to confirm his folks. It was about a chance to give the Senate an opportunity to go home and the president to carry on his business. It's not a two bites at the apple.
Well, historically, Your Honor, I would say there are very old examples of presidents using recess appointments to appoint officers who had already been nominated, whose nominations had not been acted on, as is the situation here. But I want to go even more to the balance of powers.
Well done, intercession, though. You're...
Well, I want to go to the balance of powers here, Your Honor, because at the same point, when you look at the president's authority here, Congress, the Constitution says it's a limited authority. It's a temporary appointment. And at all times, the Senate retains its authority to provide advice and consent.
It's a temporary appointment. Under your theory, how long will these appointees be in their office?
Until the end of
How long is that?
January.
How long is that?
It would be
2 years.
2 years.
That's temporary?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's temporary.
The Senate can act in the meantime.
Is that temporary? Your view of 2 years is temporary.
That's only if the Senate does not provide advice and consent. And the scenario you're posing is where the Senate wants to provide advice and consent, and they can reject the nominee.
Providing your advice and consent by slow walking it, and
right.
It frustrates everybody.
And they can
get to do that.
They can reject.
That's the thrust in Perry that we talked about in McAlpin.
That's right.
And it's frustrating to everyone.
And it's maintained here, Your Honor. On the one hand, the president has the recess appointment authority, and the Senate has the ability to act on the nominations.
Yeah, but the Senate does not have a two-sided opportunity. They can't remove that person from office during that 2 years, can they?
They can reject the nomination, and under the Pay Act, they don't pay that officer. But let's take the Senate at their word here. If we just take the Senate at their word here, you're asking before, what indication is there? This is not a disagreement with the Senate. The Senate has nowhere issued a rule, a certification anywhere that this was not a recess for recess appointment purposes. To the contrary, we have an order that provides and directs that no business will be conducted during this 20-day period in January.
Without unanimous consent.
Yes, and quite significantly, Your Honor, no communications from the president are laid before the Senate during that time. There is no way the senators would even have been informed that the president made a nomination. Those presidential messages include nominations. One presidential message that was sent was a report that the president sent on, I believe it was January 12th. That was not laid before the Senate until they returned from their 20-day recess on January 23rd.
I don't want to let this end without raising the happen question. Unless the framers intended that this power, the recess appointment power, extended only to those vacancies that arise during the recess, why did they use any verb at all? Why didn't they just say the president shall have the power to fill up vacancies, rather than saying vacancies that may happen during the recess? Because it would seem that unless they meant those that arise at that point, there's no purpose in that part of the sentence at all.
I think Attorney General Wirt made a very good observation in 1823 that this language was not clear. It does not use the term originate, and my colleague, Mr. Estrada,
referred to the term happen. And unless happen means occur, means come into being, means originate, why did they put anything other than the president shall have the power to fill up all vacancies? If they intended for him to have the power to fill up vacancies that preexisted the recess, why is that clause in there?
Well, Attorney General Wirt analyzed
it. No, don't tell me about the Attorney General. Tell me an answer to that question. Why would it be in there unless they intended it to apply only to a certain category of vacancies?
Because they wanted to ensure that the vacancies that happened to exist during a recess could be filled by the president.
If you leave out that clause, they have power to fill not only those vacancies, but all vacancies.
Your Honor,
so that clause limits. It does not expand. And why did they put that limitation in there unless they intended to create a limitation?
Let me posit another reading of it, Your Honor, that reinforces its ambiguity. If you take the clause...
No. Answer my question as to why they would put it in there unless they intended to limit.
I'm going to, Your Honor, because okay. They could have put it in there to explain and limit the period during which the president could make the appointments.
Fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess.
Right. And if you limit...
That doesn't say when the president is limited. That says
modifies
vacancies.
And you suggest that during the recess just modifies the vacancies, and the president could fill a vacancy that arose during the recess at any time, even during a session. So it is ambiguous, and we have
that
to look...
That is not what that modifies. Go back to your diagramming of sentences when you were in grammar school. That clause, that may happen during the recess of the Senate, modifies vacancies.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Not the power, not the time of the president.
In your diagramming paradigm, if you put that on the diagonal line for the modification of that noun, you have nothing to modify the appointment power
you
of the president.
You have vacancies
which suggests,
to modify. You have vacancies to
so
modify.
So if there's a vacancy that arises at...
That may happen during the recess
and then the
clause
president,
modifying something.
And then the president could fill that at any time, not just during a recess. I really think we need to look at the centuries of interpretation we have of this provision and the congressional acquiescence,
Your
Honor.
What is the narrowest possible holding that will get you what you want?
We believe that taking the Senate at its word and looking at this 20-day period in January where, by order, no business was conducted, no communications were laid before the Senate. There was no duty of attendance. The Senate itself, on December 17th, when it issued this, there are two other unanimous consent orders on
that same page that referred to it as a recess. What's the holding? I understand the factual argument. What's the holding?
That for purpose of the recess appointment clause, that was a 20-day recess, because under the functional interpretation, the plain language of recess,
we have to walk into the Capitol and see what's going on.
No, the Senate has told you this from 1905. The Senate,
the Senate did not tell us that in 1905. A committee of the Senate.
True enough.
There's a big difference.
Yes, Your Honor, but it's been embraced by the Comptroller General, a legislative official, and it's been embraced by Riddick's on the Senate's proceedings. So In addition to Attorney General Daugherty pointed to that report as the most significant analysis that he was relying on in his Attorney General opinion. So when you look at that, you look at what the Senate did. No business, no communications, no duty of attendance. No one's there. It's empty. Those are the exact factors that the Senate report and Attorney General Daugherty talk about.
If we disagreed with you and if we thought that intra-session recess appointments are unconstitutional, how should we decide the case then? You'd have to find some way to argue that this is an intercession appointment. Could you do that?
I don't believe it is under the adjournment that the Senate
So there's no way that this is an intercession appointment.
Well, when you look at the 20th Amendment, it dictates that the new session of Congress began at noon on January 3rd, and we don't rely on the pro forma session for that at all. That is erroneous.
Okay.
That is not at all. We rely on the text of the provision.
So if we decide that the Constitution gives the President this authority only in intercession, then you lose.
Well, we lose, and okay. The court goes into direct conflict with the 11th Circuit's in-bank opinion on Judge Pryor's.
We don't mind going into conflict with others.
In Judge Pryor's.
You've been around long enough to know that doesn't.
Judge Pryor,
we don't lay awake
Judge
at night
Pryor
morning.
Is a good friend. He'll understand.
And 284 other intra-session recesses. So I think that would be an extraordinary
conclusion. At the risk of prolonging this still further, what's going to cut off the possibility of a president then making appointments during a weekend recess, a holiday recess, lunch recess, for that matter?
We are not taking that position at all.
That's not what I asked you. What's going to cut that off? Right. You may not be taking it today, but what is going to...
Teddy Roosevelt's great-great-grandson may become president and try something like that again.
Attorney General Daugherty addressed
Attorney General Daugherty can't stop you. What is it that's going to stop you? He's dead. And he got in trouble before he died,
And the OLC opinion won't identify any lower limit. Why not? It's because once you remove yourself from the principle that's set forth in the Constitution itself, intercession versus intercession, you are adrift, and we come up with these explanations that really are metaphysical. And somebody has to try and tie it to the adjournment clause.
No, Your Honor, it's not tying it to the adjournment clause. It's looking to see what a de minimis break would be. And no one has suggested that lunch or a weekend would meet that requirement. And that's where various analyses have looked to the adjournment clause kind of as a de minimis, not as a absolute minimum threshold.
What's the basis for arriving at that de minimis level? What's the principle that gets you there? That says 3 days, okay, nothing under 3 days. We may be able to go to 3 days, but there's a constitutional difference between 3 days and 2 days. What's the constitutional difference between 3 days and 2 days?
It's looking at the functional practicality of the recess appointment clause, which has been done for such a long time to understand that lunches,
weekends. When is the last time we decided the constitutional distinction on functional practicality?
I'm talking about the shared understanding of the executive and legislative branch for more than a century, Your Honor. It is the Senate's report, the Comptroller General, the Attorney General's opinions, Riggs, all of these
If we are of the view that in your explanation, both parties got it wrong, that the executive, for whatever reason, was misreading the Recess Appointments Clause, and the Senate, for whatever reason, was misreading it. What duty do we do then as a court? Do we have any duty? Do we get out of it?
I think you look to the ordinary and common usage of the term recess, Your Honor, and we win on that. And you look at what the Senate...
The Senate itself said... The language, counsel.
If I could, Your Honor, I'd like to address the Happens argument.
You got another 2 minutes. I'm adding back 2 minutes. Arbitrary and capricious.
Okay, I would like to point both on the intra and the Happens argument. Petitioners actually do not present them here for decision, although they do suggest that their briefs do not do that. They simply put it in this historical framework, with which we disagree. And one thing that in the Happens argument that Attorney General Wirt brought to bear when he was annualizing the ambiguous.
He said it meant arising, right?
Well, he was. No, he said happened to exist during the recess, and he was looking at this ambiguous language of the happens term and said, let's look at it. Would this make any sense back in 1823 to have a vacancy arise on the last day of the session and then have to sit for a very long period of time during the recess? And Attorney General Wirt was advising one of the founders himself, President Monroe, and I would commend to you Professor Hartnett's Law Review article that both petitioner and their amici cite, which makes quite a case that there's reasonably both presidents, President Adams and Jefferson, also filled vacancies that happened, that arose during the session before the recess. Three circuits, the in-bank 11th, the in-bank 9th, and the second sec, have all join that. And most significantly here, Congress has acquiesced in that. In the Pay Act at 5 U.S.C. 5503, Congress specifically provides for the payment of officers who are appointed to vacancies that arise during a session before a recess that happen to exist during the recess. Again, you have a coalescence of
Is there any argument that they have acquiesced on intra-session appointments?
Certainly, there have been 285 of them that have, been confirmed by the Senate. I think that that is part of the Mistretta point we make. This is a long, long history that would be disrupted, and we believe also disrupt the balance of powers. And the one point I want to make here is, under petitioner's view, there is no one who has this appointment authority during this 20-day recess.
That's exactly correct.
I mean, that can't be right.
There isn't any question that's not only their view, but it's a very possible result of this lawsuit. You've come back to that. When you parade a horrible by, it has to look horrible.
But I'm going to Judge Griffith's question about the purpose. That was not the purpose of the framers, to leave voids and vacuums of time. The executive has a constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The NLRB was left without a quorum on January 3rd.
Certainly, the NLRB was without a quorum during much of the Bush administration. Right.
But you can certainly posit.
And tried to act anyway, and we told them they couldn't, and the Supreme Court agreed with us.
But you can certainly posit a national security scenario to think that there is a period of a vacuum that petitioners suggest, because during this period of time, they were not available.
Ms. Brinkman, the reality of it is that going back over several administrations, it's the Senate's way of telling the executive, we don't like the nominees.
But let me just say
that's exactly what it is.
But and that goes to your thrust and parry of the political branches, our position maintains that. And the last point I would make, I think, is, Your Honor, is that any recesses that are undisputed recesses, the Senate can come back. In fact, they can come back more easily to take action than here, because those the concurrent resolutions allow for their leadership to call it back, a much easier task than unanimous consent. Thank you, Your Honors.
Sorry, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Elizabeth Heaney. I'm representing the National Labor Relations Board, which is seeking enforcement of its order against Noel Canning. I'll be addressing the association standing to intervene as well as the underlying merits. And I think that Chambers counsel hit the nail on the head here when he said that this is a dispute between Noel Canning and the National Labor Relations Board. And any interest that the chamber has in this dispute between a company and an agency can certainly be brought to this court's attention in the well-accepted and very reasonable format of an amicus.
In a sense, I don't blame you for objecting to their coming in, but does it really matter? I mean, as long as you have one party with standing to raise the issues in the case, which Noel Canning unquestionably does, does it matter to you whether there's another party in there or not? We still have to decide the issue, for or against you, the same with or without the putative intervener, don't we?
I agree that with or without whether or not the associations are interveners, this court has to decide the issues before it. But it matters very much so to the board that the association not be attributed party status.
Why?
Because they lack...
That's really what I'm asking. Why does it matter to the board?
Well, the association lacks Article III status. And the board would like to prevent interveners from coming in future.
Okay, so precedent is your interest here, which is legitimate. I'm not suggesting it's not.
The fact that Noel Canning itself has standing here does not mean that the association has standing.
Certainly not. And as you may have gathered, I have some real question about their standing, but I just wondered why the board gave a darn.
Well, as you had stated earlier, Your Honor, that if you're going to parade a horrible, it needs to look like a horrible. And I think that if associations are allowed to intervene whenever a member has standing, that will be a horrible to the agency and also to this court's docket.
Thank you, counsel.
If you don't have other questions on standing, I'll certainly address the merits of the underlying ULP case, which... involves the Noel Canning's failure to bargain in good faith with the union by refusing to sign a written contract that embodied the terms to which the parties had orally agreed. And the board disagrees with Chamber Counsel that substantial evidence shows there was not a meeting of the minds. Quite frankly, the substantial evidence shows there was a meeting of the minds as to the formation of a contract. When you look at the parties' behavior right at the conclusion of the December 8th negotiation session and then the parties' behavior the day following, it shows that the parties, for all intents and purposes, had come to an agreement.
What do you say to counsel's argument that the union actually voted on a different proposition than the one allegedly agreed to?
I say that substantial evidence shows otherwise. I say that the agreement that the parties came to on December 8th is exactly what was given to the employees to vote on December 15th. The affidavit that I believe counsel is referring to, where the union's bargaining representative, Mr. Corner, had said he was going to give the employees the proposals that they had agreed to on December 8th, noting different, is an absolutely nonsensical interpretation. And quite frankly, actions speak louder than words. And the very proposal that was given to the employees is the exact proposal that the employees had agreed to on December 8th. And as for any contention that the board improperly applied state law, improperly applied federal law as opposed to state law, this court has no jurisdiction to consider that issue, Your Honors. The company failed to raise that in exceptions to the board, and the board did not consider it. And in any event, it's 60-year-old precedent that the board applied. If there are no further questions as to the merits or the standing of the association.
Seeing none, thank you, counsel. We'll hear from Mr. Copas.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Jim Coppas for Local 760 of the Teamsters Union. In its brief to the NLRB, which is what I'm going to quote is from appendix page 100, the Noel Canning Company said this to the board: an employer violates section 8A1 and 5 by refusing to execute a collective bargaining agreement incorporating all of the terms agreed upon by the parties during negotiations. That's the first legal issue they try to re-argue in this court. There's no doubt at all that that's precisely what happened here. And indeed, the company's prior excuse for not agreeing to the agreement was different than Mr. Francesco's. It was not that a different agreement had been voted, but rather an insistence that an agreement hadn't been reached. And the evidence is overwhelming on that point. The main point of this case is that the company wants to escape enforcement of the NLRB by challenging the appointments to the panel that decided this case. The president has an obligation to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and that's precisely what he did by filling the board slots and getting this case decided. The enforcement of the law is a matter of great importance to the employees in this bargaining unit because effectively the company stretching this out has meant not only were they denied the benefit of their bargain for the last 2 years, And now the company is relying on its noncompliance with the law to refuse to bargain going forward, which means from this point on, there will be no compensation increases in this bargaining unit until this is decided. We submit that the court should not allow Noel Canning to escape enforcement of the law and that it should enforce the decision of the NLRB and the panel as appointed by the president. If there are no questions?
Seeing none,
thank you.
You
very much.
I'm sure he was out of time, wasn't he? Okay, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, as to the purpose of the Appointments Clause and the Recess Appointments Clause, the President always has the appointments power. The Senate always has the power of advice and consent, that is, the power to block appointments, unless it renders itself unavailable to provide to serve that function for an extended period of time. That reflects the subsidiary role that the Recess Appointments Clause plays. That's not a problem. That's what the Constitution is meant to do. To the extent paralysis is an issue, that's not the Recess Appointments Clause. That's the quorum requirement and the fact that there are no acting board members, much like there are acting officials in other agencies. That's a different problem not meant to be solved by the Appointments
Clause. Do you have a response to Ms. Brinkman's point about the New Jersey legislature?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. First of all, it's a single legislature. Second, if they want to embrace the Senate,
I thought you were going to say, first of all, it's New Jersey. That's entirely you were going to be reprimanded if you had said that.
So a single legislature. Second, if they want to embrace the Senate Vacancies Clause, they fail on the arise prong. In 1794, the Senate refused to sit a senator appointed pursuant to the Senate Vacancy Clause because the vacancy arose there was a session taking place as opposed to during the recess.
Yeah, but the historical treatment of them really is different. The arise clause is in a much different footing.
I think the arise clause is a stronger textual argument on our favor. Yeah. But the major point, though, is that's one legislature from one state as against very first attorney general opinion that addressed the issue in 1901 going the other way by an agency that has every interest in expanding power. Here you had them go the other way. The fact that until 1945 this almost never happened, three occasions, and then happened only intermittently up until the Carter administration. Your Honor, there's a good Law Review article by Michael Carrier in the Michigan Law Review that does a good job of tracing the history of this. Third, they have the same duty of attendance in these sessions as in every other. Judge Griffith, you may recall, it's governed by Senate Rule 6. No distinction whatsoever between these sessions and any other. The exact same duty of attendance. Finally, Your Honor, on standing, I would just urge the court.
Did someone suggest the absence of a quorum?
Nobody suggested the absence of a quorum. They could have, and they didn't need unanimous consent to do it. Any senator could have walked onto that floor and demanded a quorum. If it were established.
Wouldn't he need a unanimous consent to do that?
No, Your Honor, he would not. He could have walked onto that floor and demanded a quorum. If there were no quorum established, then whoever was there, a majority of whoever was there.
He would have to come back from the West Coast to do it.
Absolutely. They could have discharged the sergeant of arms just like in any other session. No distinction whatsoever. On standing, I'd urge the court to take a close look at Alabama against FERC, 300 F3rd 877. We would submit it's on all fours with this case.
Now, wait a minute. I hate to prolong this, but I'm not sure what you just said about Alabama versus FERC.
Alabama against FERC involved a trade association that sought to intervene under Rule 15D in a petition for review from a FERC order.
Mm-hmm.
The court allowed the trade association to intervene because it satisfied two things. First, it satisfied the Rule 15D requirements, which this court has already held that we satisfy. And second, it satisfied Article 3 standing, not prudential standing. Excuse me?
Is that in your brief?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. This is cited in our briefs. Yes, it is. And just to be clear, 300 F3rd 877. And here we establish Article 3 standing because we have at least two members, Noel Canning and Goya Foods. Noel Canning, which is in this case, and Goya Foods, which had a case pending before the board when we filed this and thus faced imminent action by a quorumless board. Since we meet Rule 15D and we meet Article 3 standing, we would submit that just as in Alabama against FERC.
Is your harm as an association here that can be remedied in this case?
Well, first of all, we have a member, Noel Canning. That is.
Never mind that. Forget Noel Canning standing. They have standing. I want your associational standing. How are, sure, as an association, how are you harmed?
Two things, Your Honor. One, we are harmed whenever a member is harmed, and Noel Canning is a member. Two, we're also harmed through other members like Goya Foods, who have cases pending before the board and are facing imminent action.
Each of those is litigable in its own case. We cannot enter any order affecting Goya. I mean, we don't even know about that.
Not so, Your Honor. That's controlled by Teva Pharmaceuticals. And Teva Pharmaceuticals...
Quite so, counsel. We can't enter an order affecting another proceeding before the board.
No, but you can enter an order declaring that the general rule that the board adopted here regarding a quorum is unlawful. That is a binding ruling in the D.C. Circuit. Every NLRB...
If we're going to create a precedent that... Precedent is enough to give standing, aren't we going to be inundated?
It's not just precedent. NLRB is a party here.
They are a party here. And
yes, Your
so
Honor.
So is Noel Canning a party. And you're not a party.
And the NLRB...
And your interest is the one I'm talking about. And the precedent is what you're claiming.
Not just a precedent. The NLRB would be bound by this in the D.C. Circuit. All of our members are facing imminent action by the exact same board. It would be bound by that ruling in future litigation. So it wouldn't be able to exercise that power in any case appealable to the D.C. Circuit, which, by the way, is every single
because
one.
Because of the precedent we would have entered.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Because of the precedent we would have entered.
Because a precedent is binding on the National Labor Relations Board. And in addition, is a party.
Precedent is all you're claiming is your harm, right?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it's more than that.
Well, tell me what more than precedent it is.
It's the fact that if we are granted intervention, we have a binding ruling that is res judicata, a collateral estoppel, against the board as between the chamber and the board.
But the chamber is not a party to any of those other NLRB proceedings either.
Well, it could be, but it's binding. The fact of the matter is that it would solve the problem of the imminent quorumless action that our members are facing.
Honestly, counsel, I've never seen an association appear on the management side, if you would, of a labor dispute. Now, I've only been here 25 years, so it may have happened. But do you know of any precedent where we've allowed an association to come in an NLRB proceeding because one of their members was the employer?
Not NLRB, but in Alabama against
FERC. No, let's
FERC
talk about NLRB.
You're right, not in NLRB, but in Alabama against FERC. It's the exact same thing. It's
no, it
FERC
isn't.
Order. So,
no, it isn't the exact same thing.
I mean, FERC.
What was the proceeding in FERC?
There was a dispute between a utility company over a rate-making order.
Mm-hmm.
They lost. It came up that there was a petition for review where a trade association representing, you know, consumers came in and said, we want to intervene on appeal under Rule 15D. They hadn't properly done what was necessary to participate.
We're not going to go into how distinguishable that is from this because we have taken more time than
Your Honor.
It should be allowed.
I only meant to alert you to the case.
You're not quite patient. You're not quite keeping a straight face while you make that Alabama.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I just wanted to bring the case to the court's attention because it is the best precedent we have on
that. Attention, and it is the best you have, and that's your problem. I'm sorry. Does either of my colleagues have anything further? Nothing further from either colleague, then the case is submitted.
Thank you very much.